Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we have a terrific lineup for you today. First, what are the collective impacts of the last Supreme Court term on our lives and our rights? Then, the life, legacy, and leadership of Nelson Mandela in the words of one of his closest colleagues. Finally, in the wake of President Obama's new climate plan, three of the world's top scientists assess how to heal this planet. Last week, the Supreme Court ended its term with a number of extraordinary decisions that have the potential to impact the lives of millions of people. What does this latest round of decisions mean? Erwin Chemerinsky joins us now. Erwin Chemerinsky is the founding dean and distinguished professor of law at the University of California Irvine School of Law. He's the author of the books Constitutional Law and The Conservative Assault on the Constitution. Welcome back to the Scholar's Circle, Erwin Chemerinsky.
Oh, it's such a pleasure to be with you.
Oh, it's great to have you back again. I wanted to start with an overview of this term. When you look at it, 2012, 2013, how would you characterize the impact of this court and this particular session?
This is a term that's going to have an enormous impact. Let me pick a single example. By striking down Section 3 of the Defense Marriage Act, same-sex couples who are married will now get the benefits under over 1,100 federal laws. That's a huge effect in their lives. Or to pick another example, when the Supreme Court struck down Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act, this now means that jurisdictions with a long history of race discrimination in voting will now find it much easier to engage in that discrimination. And I think we're going to see much more in the way of efforts to disenfranchise minority voters. And that's going to matter in terms of who's elected in the future. So here we're talking about cases that aren't just abstractions, that really affect people's lives.
And when you look at these two in contrast, I mean, one seems like a real win for civil rights. The other seems to be a real loss for civil rights. How do you wrap your arms around the sort of contradiction of these?
To me, the largest contradiction was seen when one compared what the conservative judges did on Tuesday in striking down the Voting Rights Act versus what they wanted to see happen on Wednesday when they didn't want the court to strike down the Defense of Marriage Act. In Wednesday, especially Justice Scalia, but also Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Thomas Alito said, the court should defer to Congress, and Congress decided the Defense of Marriage Act is appropriate. The court shouldn't second-guess Congress and shouldn't strike down a law Congress passed. But on Tuesday, those same four justices were in the majority and gave no deference to Congress that had reauthorized the Voting Rights Act for 25 years. Congress held 12 hearings over 11 months, compiled a record of 15,000 pages showing continued race discrimination in voting, but there the conservatives didn't want to give any deference to Congress.
So how do we explain this kind of behavior?
Well, I think the way to understand the conservative justice on the Supreme Court is just read the 2012 Republican platform. And where the Republican platform condemns something like same-sex marriage, that's where the conservative justices are. And when the Republican platform opposes something like the Voting Rights Act, that's where the conservative justices are. It's ideology, pure and simple. It's not as if there's some principle of jurisprudence or court decision-making that explains what's going on here.
Now, over the history of the court, and I know that you've done quite a bit of this for your book, have you seen a court that was this ideologically driven?
Every court is ideologically driven. And so, for example, in the 1930s, the court was ideologically driven in striking down the New Deal legislation. To be fair, the Warren Court was ideologically driven. The reality is the Supreme Court is dealing with a constitution that's written in broad, open, textured language. The results that justices come to, liberal and conservative, is a function of their ideology. What makes this court different is that it's so clearly divided ideologically. You have four staunch conservatives in Roberts, Scalia, Thomas, Alito. You have four liberal justices in Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan. And then you have Anthony Kennedy. And when the court's ideologically divided, he tends to side with the conservatives about 70% of the time. This year, there were 16 ideologically divided 5-4 decisions. And Kennedy's with the conservatives in 10, and with the liberals in 6.
One article characterized this court as actually driven by two kinds of conservative leadership, one being the Roberts type of ideology and one being this kind of ideology that is Kennedy's. Do you see it that way?
Well, there are instances where Justice Kennedy is with the liberals and instances where he's not with the liberals. Justice Kennedy is with the liberals when it comes to sexual orientation issues. There have been 3 Supreme Court cases in all of American history advancing rights for gays and lesbians. all of them have now been written by Anthony Kennedy. But there are instances where Kennedy is not with the Liberals when it comes to campaign finance issues, for example, or historically when it's come to affirmative action, or more generally with regard to criminal defendants' rights. Kennedy is there with the conservatives.
Let's take a couple of these. We saw some decisions coming down with regards to affirmative action as well. What do you see there?
Well, I think the affirmative action case, Fisher versus University of Texas, is a cause for all who care about diversity in higher education to breathe a huge sigh of relief. The University of Texas followed exactly what the Supreme Court had prescribed and used race as one of many factors in admissions decisions to benefit minorities and enhance diversity. There was every reason to believe that there were 4 and maybe 5 votes on the court to eliminate affirmative action. However, that's not what the Supreme Court did. Instead, it issued a very narrow ruling. It said it wasn't going to reconsider the earlier decision, Grutter versus Bollinger, that colleges and universities have a compelling interest in a diverse student body. It wasn't going to consider the holding that colleges and universities may use race as one factor in admissions decisions. Instead, it said, what the University of Texas has to show is that there's no race-neutral way to achieve diversity. And the court sent the case back to the lower courts to decide whether Texas had adequately proven there was no race-neutral way to achieve diversity. In this way, the court didn't change the law. Colleges and universities, at least for now, can continue to engage in affirmative action. The court did as little as could possibly do. And as I say, if somebody really cares about affirmative action and diversity, I do breathe a sigh of relief.
So Adam Liptak, who writes for the New York Times, had written a piece where he said, when you look at this particular term in isolation, it looks like it has sort of, I think he used the phrase, elements of modesty. But he argued that really Roberts is strategizing to use the liberals' consensus on some opinions or agreement on some opinions to then knock down these pillars that we may have had historically. This is what he argued happened with the Voting Rights Act, using opinions from a 2009 case. Would you agree with him on this?
I do. I think some decisions this term were minimalist or modest. The affirmative action case that we were just talking about was minimalist. On the other hand, the decision with regard to voting rights, Shelby County, Alabama versus Holder, that strikes down Section 4 and, in fact, Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, was anything but modest. Also, there were a whole series of cases involving claims against business by employees, by consumers, by small businesses, where the court was anything but modest. And all these 5-4 decisions in these areas came down strong on the side of corporations and big businesses.
Yes, in fact, I think I saw that something like 3/4 of the decisions that involved something that would affect business, the Chamber of Commerce's position won.
This is the most pro-business court that there's been since the mid-1930s. And I don't want, amidst all of the attention to the race and marriage cases, for us to lose sight of, on Monday of this week, the court handed down 2 decisions that are going to make it much harder for employees who suffer discrimination to sue. Last week, the court handed down a decision that's going to make it much harder for small businesses to be able to sue big corporations. On Monday, the court handed down a decision that's going to make it much harder for patients who are injured by generic drugs to sue makers of those drugs. These are positions favored by the Chamber of Commerce, and these are cases that are going to affect each of us individuals when we're hurt by corporations.
And how did they justify these opinions legally?
In each instance, the court was interpreting a federal statute, but the court, I think, in each instance, interpreted the federal statute not to fulfill the intent of Congress. Let me take a single example. There was a case on Monday that involved a woman who used a pain reliever and suffered a rare side effect. She developed burns and blisters all over her body that left her terribly disfigured and blind. And she wanted to sue the maker of the generic version of the drug, saying that its design defect had never been disclosed to patients or to doctors. The Supreme Court, in a 5-4 decision, held that makers of generic drugs cannot be sued on a failure to warn theory. 70% of all prescriptions in the United States are filled with generic drugs. If there's a generic equivalent to a non-generic, that goes up to 90%. All of us who take generic drugs are just out of luck if we want to sue the makers for failing to adequately warn. This seems to me favoring big business over us consumers and patients in a major way.
And I can't quite get my hands around the legal reasoning
What the Supreme Court said is that under a federal law, the Hatch-Waxman Act, a generic drug can be sold if it's chemically the same as a brand name drug, and if it has the same warning label that's approved for a brand name drug. Therefore, the court said you can't sue a generic drug maker so long as it does that. Well, the Hatch-Waxman law was adopted to protect consumers, to allow generic drugs to be sold in the United States. It never had in mind immunizing generic drug makers. The irony of this decision is if somebody takes the brand name version of the drug and they're hurt, they can sue the manufacturer. But if you take the generic version of the drug, you can't. That makes no sense. That was Justice Sotomayor's point, her dissent.
So while the Chamber of Commerce is winning the majority of cases that deal with big business, is it also significant that President Obama's administration lost something like two-thirds of cases?
It is, and this is part of a trend. Usually the federal government has been much more successful in the Supreme Court. I think last year the Solicitor General's office, that's the office that represents the federal government in the Supreme Court, lost about half of the cases. This year they did even worse. I think what that reflects is this is a court that generally doesn't defer to the other branches of government. This is a court that believes it has the answers and it's going to impose them, except when it doesn't want to.
Historically, it was considered the least dangerous branch, and it seems that it's in some ways showing itself up as more dangerous.
Of course, it all depends on the area. On Wednesday, joyful that the Supreme Court struck down Section 3 of the Defense of Marriage Act, and by dismissing the challenge to Prop 8, the effect is going to be, I think, relatively soon that same-sex couples are going to be marrying in California. I wanted the Supreme Court to do that. On Tuesday, I was terribly upset that the Supreme Court struck down the Voting Rights Act. And so it's the nature of an institution like the Supreme Court, and especially this Supreme Court, that there's going to be instances where we're very pleased and instances where we're very unhappy.
Let's take a look at a couple of other rights. There were some cases that dealt with Fourth Amendment rights, including taking of the DNA. What happened there?
And I find it a disturbing decision. The case is Maryland versus King. Maryland has a law that says if anyone's arrested for a serious crime, DNA will be routinely taken. The DNA is not taken to investigate the person for the crime for which he has been arrested. The DNA is taken to see if it matches DNA in the police database for unsolved crimes. King was arrested for an assault. DNA was taken from him, not with regard to the assault, but to see if it matched some unsolved crime. His DNA did match that for an unsolved rape, and he was then convicted. And the question is, does it violate the Fourth Amendment for the police to take DNA from somebody without any basis for believing they're linked to the crimes they're going to be investigated for? And the Supreme Court 5-4 said it does not violate the Fourth Amendment to routinely take DNA from people who are arrested. Justice Kennedy wrote the opinion for the court there. Justice Scalia wrote the dissent. Justice Scalia said, this is the first time we've ever allowed the government to search somebody for a crime for which they're not a suspect. He said, unlike fingerprinting, an enormous amount can be learned about a person from his or DNA. What we can know about somebody from DNA is exponentially increasing each year. So there really is a risk to our privacy.
Right to abortion. Did we see any significant movement there?
The court did not have any abortion cases on the docket this term, but this week they've granted review in a couple of cases to be heard next year with regard to abortion. One involves buffer zones around reproductive health care facilities, and the court yesterday granted review in a case coming out of Oklahoma that had a law that greatly limited the ability to use medicine like RU486 to induce abortions. And I think these will be really important cases on the docket for October term 2013.
Are there other areas of our law that you see shaping that came up in this particular term?
Sure. I think there were a number of cases this term that didn't get media attention but are going to affect us. One example is a case a week ago Monday, Salinas versus Texas. It involves a person who was being questioned by the police but not under arrest. He didn't answer some of the questions from the police. And at his trial, the prosecutor pointed to his silence as evidence of guilt. And the question was, can the police use and the prosecutor use silence as evidence of guilt, especially before somebody's been arrested, before they've been informed of the right to remain silent? And the Supreme Court 5-4 said, if the defendant doesn't specifically say, I wish to remain silent, silence can be used against him or her. I thought the dissent made a great point. What better way to invoke your right to remain silent than being silent? But that's not enough. And so now it's important that everybody knows if they're questioned by the police and they want to remain silent, they need to use those magic words saying, I wish to remain silent. There's a term with highs and lows. I think the most important high of the term is striking down Section 3 of the Defense of Marriage Act. And I do believe that the court dismissing the Prop 8 case means that sometime soon, even this summer, same-sex couples will finally be able to marry in California. And that's a huge advance in every way for those couples, for symbolically what we mean in terms of equal protection and equal dignity under the law. And so that for itself is a reason to rejoice about the term, though there were many decisions to be upset about.
Erwin Chemerinsky, it's always such a pleasure to have you on.
It's my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. Albie Sachs is a South African human rights lawyer and scholar who worked alongside Nelson Mandela to end apartheid in their country. In 1994, Mandela appointed Sachs to South Africa's new constitutional court, the equivalent of the Supreme Court in the U.S. Sachs joined us recently to reflect on the legacy and leadership of Nelson Mandela. So it's great to get you back on the air with us again, Albie Sachs. And you've had this long history with the freedom movement in South Africa, and you've got this long friendship with Nelson Mandela. I thought we should perhaps talk about this freedom movement in light of what he has brought us. Let's start with your friendship. How would you describe your friendship with Nelson Mandela?
Yes, somehow the word friendship doesn't quite capture it. It's a connection, association, which included friendship, but it is much stronger than just having a pal or somebody you worked with. It was a shared ideal coming from totally different backgrounds. It was working together. It was being separated by geography, by history, by the world, and being brought back together by the world. So it's a connection that's very, very strong. It's not peculiar just to me and Madiba, as we call him, Mandela. It's a kind of relationship that thousands of us got involved in the course of joining the struggle. I mean, the very first time I heard the name Nelson Mandela, it was when I was about to join in the Defiance of Unjust Laws campaign. At 1952, I'm 17. I'm leading a small group of whites sitting on benches marked non-whites only in the General Post Office in Cape Town. And 10,000 black people had voluntarily gone to jail because they said, we just can't put up with these restrictions and being treated as second-class or third-class or 20th-class citizens in the land of our birth. And the reason I mentioned Mandela is he was the volunteer in chief. He was the number one person to go to jail. I was like number 10,000, whatever it might be. And it was so important that he was number one because he had qualified as a lawyer. He was in legal practice. He couldn't vote. He couldn't travel freely. He couldn't be a citizen. But he could accumulate a bit of money. He could have a lot of status and prestige in the society. And until then, most of the very few middle-class leaders of the African National Congress saw their role as being intermediaries between the masses, between the people, and the white regime. And they would more or less say, now don't rock the boat and don't behave in an unruly way and obey the law, otherwise you'll make our task as intermediaries more difficult. This was a new generation, a younger, more activist generation, and Mandela said he has to be the first to go to jail to show that this is a united movement and of all the African people and all the people supporting them. And so there was a moral connection, if you like, between me and Nelson Mandela from my very first political act. Later on, when I carried on with my law studies, whenever I went up to Johannesburg, I would pay a courtesy call to the offices of the first black firm of attorneys in Johannesburg, I think in South Africa, called Mandela and Tambo, Tambo being Oliver Tambo. Another very, very great African leader who had an enormous impact on me in years in exile later on. And I would just go and say hello, and I was always very well received with a cup of tea, very, very crowded offices, and either Mandela or Tambo would say a few words and ask how the struggle is getting on in Cape Town. And you never said the struggle is doing badly. You always said the struggle is doing well. And then you'll see how busy we are, because the poor came with all their grievances and problems and so on to their lawyers. And then I would say goodbye. It was just a kind of nod on my part towards this first firm of black attorneys in Johannesburg. The next phase is reading about him. We had adopted the Freedom Charter, which set out the vision of South Africa belonging to everybody who lived in it, black and white together. These are the opening words. And it called for full equality. And the racist government said that's treason, and put 156 people on trial for treason. And Nelson Mandela was one of them. At that stage, he wasn't a top leader of the ANC. The top leadership were people like Chief Albert Luthuli, a very wise and very wonderful and embracing person, with all the qualities that we later on saw in Mandela himself. And then there were other people like J.B. Marks, Moses Kotane, Yusuf Dadu. These were the top leaders, and then a younger generation coming to the fore. And it was during the treason trial that Nelson Mandela emerged as somehow preeminent amongst the 156. It's not only that he was taller and better dressed and more stylish than anybody else. He had an eloquence and a composure and a kind of controlled combativity that made him stand out from all the other accused, who included a number of other lawyers like himself. So they're on trial, they're defending themselves, they're being defended by some of the best counsel in the country, and literally head and shoulders above everybody else was the person of Nelson Mandela. And now he became more of a national leader, still under people like Albert Luthuli as the elected leaders of the ANC. Then came Sharpeville, the massacre. People shot dead, refusing to carry passes, most of them running away. And it produced a shockwave in South Africa. And what would the government do? Concede to the demand for equality or set up a wall of granite? And the government chose the latter. The ANC is outlawed. The Pan-Africanist Congress is outlawed. The Communist Party was already unlawful. Newspapers were banned, individuals were restricted from moving and speaking at gatherings, and the majority people not only were disenfranchised, they couldn't complain about the fact that they didn't have the vote, and apartheid was being forced down their throats. And now the eloquent and well-dressed and composed Nelson Mandela, the lawyer, became Nelson Mandela, the outlaw, underground. He was called the Black Pimpernel. He demanded that South African government meet with leaders of the broad population in South Africa to draft a new constitution that would guarantee rights to everybody. And he was on the run. He evaded capture for a long time. And it's clear that that was the stage when he became now head of the armed wing of the ANC. I think people often forget that Nelson Mandela wasn't just a wise statesperson. He was a soldier. He left the country unlawfully. He got training in Algeria, which had just become independent then. He came back into South Africa to help with the first groups of combatants who are now using explosives to blow up apartheid targets. He was captured. At that stage, the full scale of his work wasn't known. Put on trial, sentenced to 5 years jail. He made a magnificent speech in court. It's not as well known as other speeches he made later on. But he really said to the magistrate, I'm not challenging your competence and right to hear the matter as a personal matter, but I am saying that in South Africa, it's the guilty who drag the innocent before the courts. Very composed, carefully thought through, and he was given the maximum sentence of 5 years imprisonment. And while in prison, other leaders of the underground resistance were captured at the place known as Rivonia, and now he became accused number one in the famous Rivonia trial. And that's when, again, the full qualities of Nelson Mandela as a leader amongst leaders and amongst leaders of a mass movement, not just followers of an individual, he became the most articulate spokesperson for the ANC, for the underground resistance. And at the moment, before sentence was imposed and the accused is given a right to make a statement from the dockets called, it's part of the procedure. You're not cross-examined, you just make a statement. It doesn't carry the same amount of weight in law as witness and testimony under oath when you're cross-examined, but it has to be taken into account. And the advantage is you can speak nonstop without interruption. And that's when he made his famous speech ending with the words, "I have fought against white domination, I fought against black domination, I fought to create a democratic South Africa, home to everybody who lives in it. These are my ideals," and he said in his prepared statements, "these are ideals for which I'm prepared to die." His lawyer said, "Nelson, that's a little bit provocative. Why don't you just soften it a bit?" So he ended up by saying, "I've fought for these ideals, and if necessary, I'm prepared to die for them." And these were the last words that anybody heard from Mandela for 27 years. He was like blotted out. And yet what emerged was the power of silence. This voice of the person who'd been silenced just became clamant, became powerful. And all over the world, there were campaigns for the release of Nelson Mandela and the other accused. And I remember I'd just come out of hospital after being blown up by a bomb placed by South African agents in my car in Mozambique. I was very weak and fragile, but I was determined to go to Wembley to the Free Mandela concert. I was a bit nervous. It was billed as a pop concert for the young people of Britain to show their support for Mandela. And I thought, well, what do you do at a pop concert? Do you stand up? Do you wave your arms? Do you... You know, it was just something new for me. I'd never been to an event like that. In the event, I arrived there. There were 70,000 young people. Archbishop Trevor Huddleston, long supporter of the ANC, goes to the microphone and says, "We are gathered today to demand the release of Nelson Mandela." And we just cheered and cheered and cheered. And there were great stars from all over the world. But somehow the music of the voices of 70,000 young people who we were told at the time, young people aren't interested in politics and they don't have any ideals. Well, the Wembley Free Mandela concert proved that they were wrong. And 2 years later, Nelson Mandela was freed, and it was a moment of great jubilation. But it wasn't simply coming into the kingdom that he was due to inherit. It was to carry on with the new task of providing leadership, a steady, calm, thoughtful leadership in as part of a team, a very strong collective team.
We just lost Albie Sachs due to a telephone drop, but we will get him back on the air again very soon. Albie Sachs is a former justice in South Africa's Constitutional Court and a longtime friend of Nelson Mandela. Sachs' books include The Jail Diary of Albie Sachs, The Soft Vengeance of a Freedom Fighter, and The Strange Alchemy of Life and Law. When we come back, three of the world's top scientists assess how to heal this planet. Stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, and I'm Maria Armudian. Last week, President Obama announced his plan to bypass Congress and enact executive policies to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and combat climate change. While his speech and plan have been hailed by environmental and climate experts, the global problem needs a much bigger solution, according to scientists. What are we facing, and what are the solutions? With us are three top scientists. Michael Mann is a professor of meteorology at Penn State University and the director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. Dr. Mann is author of Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and The Hockey Stick in the Climate Wars. He is also a lead author for the 2007 Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, for which he, his co-authors, and Vice President Al Gore won the Nobel Prize. Peter Ward is professor of biology at the University of Washington. He is the author of Our Flooded Earth, Under a Green Sky, and Out of Thin Air, Dinosaurs, Birds, and Earth's Ancient Atmosphere. Mark Jacobson also joins us. He is a professor of civil and environmental engineering and director of the Atmosphere Energy Program at Stanford University. He is the author of Air Pollution and Global Warming, History, Science, and Solutions, and Atmospheric Pollution, History, Science, and Regulation. Welcome to the three of you. Thank you so much for being with us. I'd like to start with the science and the reality of what we have today. We recently passed this 400 part per million concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. That's about 50 parts per million higher than what is the tipping point number that scientists have been saying. We're seeing considerable changes in the weather, storm patterns. Michael Mann, can you give us a briefing about what it is we're facing?
Sure. We know that we've just passed this number, 400 parts per million, which is unprecedented in modern civilization, in modern human history. In fact, we probably have to go back several million years to find CO2 concentrations, carbon dioxide concentrations, that were that high in the past. And so we are engaged in an unprecedented experiment with the Earth, with fossil fuel burning and the elevation of the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and we are already seeing the impacts of climate change. It is, of course, true that you can't point at any one specific weather event and say for certain that that was due to climate change, but we are seeing more extreme weather of various sorts as a result of the loading of the weather dice by climate change.
Two things that you just said. One is you use the word experiment, leading one to think that maybe we don't really know what's coming. But at the same time, we know from some of the history and some of the research you've done, like one you did in 2006, about the Atlantic hurricane trends being linked to climate change. How do we piece all this together?
You know, we understand the basic science here, the basic physics. It's not very complicated. You sometimes hear the claim made that climate change, that global warming, is based on elaborate models that can't be trusted. Just the opposite is the case. It's based on simple physics and chemistry we've known for nearly two centuries, the greenhouse effect, irrefutable measurements of how we are increasing the concentrations of these greenhouse gases in the atmosphere through fossil fuel burning. We understand the physics in the chemistry well enough to draw certain conclusions. And one of those conclusions is that we will see far more warming over the next century, and we will see more widespread drought, and we will see more sea level rise. We will see an array of far greater and potentially more damaging impacts of climate change if we continue on the course that we're on, if we continue to pump these greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. We're only seeing the tip of the veritable iceberg right now, and already we know that that's associated with more widespread drought, record-breaking heat, wildfires that are far more extensive and damaging than anything we've seen in the past.
Peter Ward, you have argued that the Earth is growing less inhabitable, partly being climate-driven. How much is climate related to this habitability, and can it be reversed?
Well, habitability is an astronomical term, and in some ways, that's kind of a misnomer. I don't really think the Earth will become less habitable. It might become less habitable in terms of surface area for we humans. We do a lot better on solid land than we do shallow marine oceanic conditions. If you're in Bangladesh within the next century or two centuries, you're really going to want more solid land. I see look in the deep past, and you will find times when carbon dioxide levels were as little as, say, 800 to 1,000 parts per million. And there's clear evidence that there was little, if any, ice sheet presence on the planet all the way back to the Cretaceous, there are arguments back and forth whether there were substantial ice sheets or not, but without doubt it was a warmer place, and really without doubt sea level was much, much higher. And my greatest fear, of course, is the agricultural output of humans as we inexorably increase our population, heading up to 8 to 9 to 10 billion people by the end of the century, according to some people, we're reducing the most important of all agricultural fields, and those are on deltas. Deltas don't like even a meter sea level rise. The rice output of this planet really keeps a lot of us fed, and if we melt ice sheets, not ice caps, but ice sheets, sea level rises very quickly, as Michael said.
The climate factors into this exactly how, and how does it relate to the extinction patterns that you have been studying?
Michael hit it all. I mean, the climate is affected especially by droughts. Places like the Great Valley, where it snows in the winter, the snow line rises. It doesn't snow in the winter anymore. It comes down as rain. But by the summertime, when the farmers of the Great Valley of California really need a lot of water for irrigation, it isn't there anymore. The same thing has happened in China. You're seeing enormous fights taking place for all the water coming out of the Himalayas between China and Pakistan. And that we will increasingly see this strife and increasingly see, I think, the forced migration of various peoples to try to find adequate farming land. The drought pattern that Michael mentioned is part of this. Sea level rise is a second part of this. Look, we depend upon stability for agriculture. The Farmer's Almanac, year after year, we depend that this particular wheat crop or that rice crop is going to come back. But with rapid climate change, it may not. In terms of longer-term processes, we do know that all of the major mass extinctions, including now the Cretaceous-Paleogene mass extinction, had a component of rapid greenhouse gas increases from volcanic sources. It used to be thought that the KPG, as we call it, the old KT, was almost exclusively asteroidal from its content of extinction, but the Deccan Traps, big flood basalts, were massive volumes of lava poured out onto the Earth's surface, and at the same time, cause huge amounts of greenhouse gases to enter the atmosphere. We see that at the end of the Permian. We see it at the end of the Cretaceous, at the end of the Triassic. We now have just documented it from our work at the end of the Devonian that this rapid rise causes oceanic currents to reduce. And as they do, oxygen content of the deep oceans diminishes. And when it gets down to a certain very low level, we change over the microbial content, producing very rapid marine extinction.
Mark Jacobson.
I think it's really important to address the rapid climate change today because in addition to all the effects mentioned, the sea ice in the Arctic is disappearing rapidly. It may disappear entirely, at least in the summer, but possibly year-round within 10 to 30 years. And this could cause a positive feedback that can accelerate climate change even more. Severe storminess is a significant problem. The effects of global warming on air pollution, the enhancement of air pollution due to higher temperatures, already 2.5 to 3 million people die every year from pollution. That is increasing as the climate is getting warmer. And all these, the air pollution problem, the climate problem, they all speak to the need for rapid solutions to them. And I can't stress how urgent it is to have solutions that are implemented immediately, and we can't wait like 10, 20, or 30 years before we start implementing them.
One of the questions I have before we talk about the specific solutions, President Obama has introduced this new plan that he's going to take on relatively unilaterally because the Congress is certainly not being very helpful. I understand that a lot of elevated emissions are actually coming from places like China and India. If the United States were to take on an aggressive climate plan, how much difference will it make if the other parts of the world are then increasing their emissions? Michael Mann, why don't you start?
Sure. I think it's a matter of moral authority and leadership. It is true that the greatest increase in greenhouse gas emissions is likely to come from the developing world. But in turn, they look at the U.S. and they say, you had 2 centuries of free access to fossil fuel energy. Don't we deserve our turn? And it's difficult for us to tell them otherwise if we don't have our own house in order. And so what I think the president's directive, the president's plan does is at the very least establish that the U.S. is taking this issue seriously, that we are going to do something about our ongoing greenhouse gas emissions. It's unfortunate that intransigence in the Congress has led to these executive actions being the only way to deal with our rising greenhouse gas emissions. After all, to solve this problem the way many conservatives say they would like to see the problem solved, you have to put a dollar amount on the emission of carbon. You've got to price the emission of carbon into the economy. And there are free market approaches to doing that, whether they be carbon taxes or cap and trade legislation. The bottom line is that because we have had a Congress that's unwilling to have that important discussion about comprehensive energy and climate plan, we can only rely right now, at least, on these sorts of executive actions.
Let's turn to some of these solutions. Mark Jacobson, perhaps I should hand this to you first to outline the various types of solutions that you have analyzed. You looked at a wide range and assessed them really for their feasibility on a number of variables.
Well, we've looked at different methods of addressing global warming, air pollution, and energy security. And the first step was to evaluate different technologies, and the technologies that seemed to be the best were kind of obvious, didn't require too much of a study, but we did do a study looking at wind and concentrated solar power, photovoltaics, geothermal power, some tidal, a little bit of wave, even though those aren't too large of technologies, and some hydroelectricity. So these are recommended options, which we call wind, water, and solar technologies, or WWS. Powering electricity and hydrogen. So our idea would be to convert the entire world's energy infrastructure for all purposes, that's electricity, transportation, heating and cooling, and industrial processes, to one driven by electricity, primarily powered by these energy technologies, and some amounts of hydrogen that are developed from electricity. We did not recommend nuclear power, coal with carbon capture or sequestration, natural gas or biofuels of any type, either for heating or electricity. Not because some of these aren't better in some respects than what we have today, but because they're not nearly so good as what we could have with wind, water, solar. For example, natural gas puts out about 60 times more carbon equivalent emissions than wind energy per kilowatt hour. Nuclear is about 9 to 25 times more when you account for not only the life cycle emissions, but also the opportunity costs from the long time lag between planning and operation. But based on the best technologies that we proposed, we developed plans for the U.S. and worldwide in some individual states now, California and New York in particular, to repower either the states or the countries or the world with these energy technologies, and looked at the technical and economic feasibility of doing this. And we found that there was no technical or economic even limit. Most of the barriers were social and political. For example, to repower the entire world's energy infrastructure, the first thing we found is that if you do this conversion to electricity and electrolytic hydrogen, you can reduce the world power demand without changing your habits by about 32% because of the efficiency of electricity versus combustion. But then, and then you can add additional efficiency measures to reduce that demand. And then the rest could be powered by these wind, water, and solar technologies. And the land areas would not be large. Maybe for the world, it'd be about 0.6% of the land area, plus some offshore area for what we call footprints, and then additional 1% for spacing between, for example, wind turbines, which is open space. And the materials are not limits. The costs of clean energy are coming down. Onshore wind right now and hydro and geothermal are all cost competitive. Wind was the largest new source of electric power in the U.S. last year, followed by natural gas, and solar and coal were tied for third and fourth. The nice thing about these technologies is the fuel cost is essentially free, and so you stabilize the fuel costs, whereas fossil fuel costs keep rising each year. And so we can see that in the states, for example, in the U.S., with the highest penetration of wind, which are South Dakota, Iowa, North Dakota, Minnesota, and Wyoming, the cost of electricity in those states has gone up only 2 cents a kilowatt hour between 2003 and 2011, whereas all the other states went up about 3.6 cents. Hawaii went up 17 cents a kilowatt hour because of the high fossil fuel cost, fuel costs themselves relative to wind in particular. So we've looked at this in detail and also in terms of the job creation and found you can get a lot of jobs, especially in the solar industry, and you don't lose. So there's the job benefits, there's stabilizing the price benefits, and there's the reduction of all the air pollution. As I mentioned before, 2.5 to 3 million people are killed each year prematurely from air pollution. That would be eliminated. And global warming emissions would also be eliminated through this plan, since everything that's or just about everything, since there's some agricultural stuff that's not eliminated, this is all energy-related emissions, would all be set to zero.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're talking about real solutions to the climate change problem. Peter Ward, we should bring you in to talk about the agricultural aspect and the population aspect, two things that you mentioned. How do we address these?
One point that is related to that that I think didn't get enough comment here, you're asking how would you get India and China to actually start mending their ways? Well, we in the U.S., of course, with our standard of living, are still per capita producing as much carbon emissions or more than any other individual people on the planet. But I think moral authority that Michael said just isn't going to work. They're going to just say, hey, look, you guys have that high standard of living, and we don't. So there's sort of two ways to this, is that you try to get to the rest of the world up to an equivalent standard of living. Those countries that are rich enough can afford ecological and actually good solutions to energy problems and pollution problems. But cheap energy is the way that a country that is not rich gets rich, and cheap energy means coal. To my sense, we have to stop all coal burning on this planet. It's the single most dangerous aspect, followed maybe by Athabasca tar sands from Canada. I mean, these are unbelievably dangerous aspects to the global climate. Coal burning in China, you hear all kinds of apocryphal stories about how many plants open per week and on, but Obama's right. It is the coal-fired power plants that themselves are really a major problem with this.
And in terms of the agriculture and the issue around feeding the growing population, any ideas?
We all talk about cutting emissions. Why don't we talk about cutting population? In the 1970s, there was a very powerful group called ZPG, or Zero Population Growth. Well, that's essentially gone. Part of the equation certainly has to be reducing the number of humans to feed. And yet that conversation is never brought up. It needs to be part of the whole climate change population, because the more humans there are, the more rapidly we change the climate. In terms of agriculture, David Battisti at the University of Washington, where I work, has published a very scary finding that, in fact, rising carbon dioxide reduces crop output of some very important crops. And so we really need to look closely. Personally, I favor genetically engineered crops to some extent, and yet we know that these can cause runaway genes to escape and that they themselves can create enormous problems. So technology in itself is going to be part of the solution, but technology always presents a dangerous aspect to itself. We have to be able to feed all these people, because when we don't, when sea level covers over a significant portion of cropland, and it will, we produce global conflict. So to me, global conflict, somebody who lets off a nuclear bomb somewhere, and I'll tell you, you've got a world that's very, very badly damaged, and populations trying to move from one place to another in the next century could very well be the excuse for someone to do that.
Michael Mann.
Yeah, well, I think one implicit point here that we haven't fully fleshed out is the fact that our emission of carbon is actually doing damage. It's doing monetary damage. It's costing us about $1 trillion in global gross domestic product a year. It's already costing us more than any action to curtail greenhouse gas emissions would cost. So the damages already outweigh any costs of mitigation. And when you incorporate that, when you take into account the damage that it's doing to food security, national security, water security, human health, air quality, as Mark alluded to, agriculture, as Peter has alluded to, when you incorporate those damages into the equation, what you find is that it already is economically more favorable to develop and scale up renewable energy technologies, non-carbon emitting energy technologies. And so again, the marketplace can solve this problem as long as the playing field is level. But right now, the playing field isn't level. We're greatly subsidizing fossil fuel energy, which we know is degrading the climate. It's degrading the planet. And we're not providing equal incentives for other renewable sources of energy, which, as Mark has explained, really could be scaled up to meet our energy demands in a relatively short amount of time if we were properly incentivized the development and the deployment of these technologies.
Mark Jacobson?
Yes, I can agree with what everybody else has said so far. And we need this rapid transformation. We heard President Obama give his speech the other day, and while I encourage the direction he's taking, I kind of fear that what he was proposing was very small in terms of actual solution to our problem. Just for example, you know, he's proposing 6 million homes be powered by renewable energy by 2020. Well, that sounds like a lot, but it's only 4.5% of the homes in the United States and it doesn't even account for commercial and government buildings. He's proposing 3 billion metric tons of accumulated carbon cuts in the next 20 years, but that's only half the annual carbon emissions of the U.S., so it's really effectively a total of 1/40 the annual emissions are being cut each year. He wanted to reduce subsidies from fossil fuels, but he's giving an $8 billion loan guarantee for coal with carbon capture, which is another subsidy. So, which in coal with carbon capture actually increases air pollution emissions because you need 25% more energy to run the carbon capture equipment, and therefore 25% more mining and transport of coal, sulfur emissions, particulate matter emissions, hydrocarbon, mercury emissions. Everything goes up except for the carbon dioxide comes down, and it doesn't even come down a whole lot because you still have mining and transport of the coal. So you still have about 50 times more carbon than wind energy. And that, well, he is proposing energy efficiency measures, which are good. Those are a good part of it. But everything else is pretty trivial and in terms of what we really need to do. And so I'd really encourage, you know, policymakers to look hard at what is needed and take the big steps because, you know, at this pace we're going, you know, nothing beneficial is going to come of this. And we need these kind of much more rapid changes over a shorter period of time.
Well, maybe we should talk about the policy making in politics. Michael Mann, you've been very engaged in both the science and the policy process, and you've been sort of personally injured by the rough and tumble. Can these big solutions be advanced at this point? And along with that, given the last wave of storms and droughts, particularly in Oklahoma, have you seen the denial senators such as Imhoff change, or is there still a strong denial lobby?
Well, sadly, I think as long as there is huge amounts of funding from fossil fuel interests and the various front groups that they fund, we're probably not going to see dramatic changes in the politics of this issue right now. That is, in fact, what forced the president to take, you know, what Mark has admittedly described as fairly modest executive actions. In essence, we're hemorrhaging carbon into the atmosphere, and the president's plan amounts to a few Band-Aids. It's not going to be the solution to the problem. What we need to do, of course, is to incentivize a move away from fossil fuel energy, and you're not going to do that without pricing carbon into the marketplace. And, you know, increasingly, you hear conservatives speaking out. In fact, to some extent, this latest executive action was a signal to conservatives as to why they should have been pushing for marketplace solutions earlier, because in the absence of a market-based solution, you're going to see other approaches, like executive approaches, that to some will seem heavy-handed. There are an increasing number of conservatives, people on the conservative side of our political spectrum, that recognize that climate change is real. We can't just wish it away. We can't pretend it doesn't exist, though we do have fossil fuel-funded politicians like James Inhofe continuing to claim that it's a hoax when the science is overwhelmingly on the side of the problem being real and the issue being a real threat if we don't do something. Now, there are, like I said, an increasing number of conservatives, people like David Frum, who was a former speechwriter for President Bush, he used to write for the National Review, and has come out and said, we need to explore free market solutions to pricing carbon. That's the conservative approach to dealing with a problem that is very real. And so what I'm hoping, and what we are starting to see, is a bit of a schism within the conservative community between the sort of far-right Tea Party, like Koch brother-funded politicians like James Inhofe, and the sort of thinking conservatives like David Frum, who want to have that worthy debate, because there is a worthy debate to be had about policy, about how to go about solving this problem. But there isn't a worthy debate to be had about whether or not the problem exists. And it is my hope that what we're going to see is some of those conservatives become part of a larger coalition for moving forward, having that policy debate about how to solve the problem, but recognizing that the problem is real, recognizing that climate change presents one of the greatest threats to human civilization, to national security. I think we're going to see the problem begin to become framed in those terms, and we will see action. We will see, you know, momentum towards the direction of solving the problem when that happens.
Peter Ward, put this into the long historic context that you've been studying.
Well, there's the famous overused saying that those who ignore history are actually, in our case, doomed to repeat it. My biggest frustration with the whole climate change debate has been how little deep time has been used to better understand. The experiment we're doing has been done over and over in the past, not by Volvos, but by volcanoes. RealClimate.org, which is, I think, the most successful and interesting of all the educational avenues, is read by the faithful. We are unable to penetrate with this message beyond the group of scientists and the people who actually do understand this. I teach a class in evolution, and we start out the class 300 people strong with who doubts that evolution, organic evolution, is real, and who doubts that climate change is real. It started out 5 years ago at about 15%. This last year, it's up to 30%, and that's entering freshmen who are supposedly the best of the best of Washington State high school seniors. We are failing at the public education of trying to get people to understand science and realize that there's perhaps nothing more important than understanding. And finally, we all have to let citizens know that, in fact, one person can make a huge difference. If you look at your carbon footprint through your life and then start multiplying that, because many people come up to me and say, oh, gosh, it's so depressing. What can I do? I can't do anything. We really need to turn that around, that each person on this planet has a stake in it, but is also a part of the problem.
Well, that's perfect place to end. I couldn't have done it better. Mark Jacobson, Peter Ward, Michael Mann, a very big thank you for your work and for sharing your work with us and our listeners.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Maria.
Michael Mann is a professor of meteorology at Penn State University and the director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. Dr. Mann is author of Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and The Hockey Stick in the Climate Wars. He is also a lead author for the 2007 Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, for which he, his co-authors, and Vice President Al Gore won the Nobel Prize. Peter Ward is professor of biology at the University of Washington. He is the author of Our Flooded Earth, Under a Green Sky, and Out of Thin Air, Dinosaurs, Birds, and Earth's Ancient Atmosphere. Mark Jacobson is a professor of civil and environmental engineering and director of the Atmosphere Energy Program at Stanford University. He is the author of Air Pollution and Global Warming, History, Science, and Solutions, and Atmospheric Pollution, History, Science, and Regulation. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to the Scholar Circle team who makes this show possible, Ankina Aghasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Leonardo Alanis, and Joe Pinto. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed a part of the show, you can go back either to the kpfk.org audio archives, or you can go to scholarcircle.org. You can hear us on iTunes and on Stitcher, and you can follow me at @armudian. The drumfish, they beach themselves in Harukari. The blackbirds, they fell in thousands from the sky.